A fitting epitaph. After their victory at Urabain, the months passed both quickly and slowly for Aragorn. Quickly because there was much for him and Saphira to do, and rare was the day that they were not exhausted by sundown. Slowly because he continued to feel a lack of purpose, despite the many tasks Queen Nessawada gave them. And it seemed to him as if they were idling in a patch of becalmed water, waiting for something, anything, to push them back into the main current. He and Saphira stayed in Urabain for another 4 days after Nessawada was chosen queen, helping establish the Vardan's presence there and throughout the surrounding area. Much of that time they spent dealing with the inhabitants of the city, usually placating crowds who were furious with some action of the Vardans, and hunting groups of soldiers who had fled Urabain and were preying upon travellers, peasants, and nearby estates to support themselves. He and Saphira also participated in the effort to rebuild the city's massive front gate, and at Nasawada's behest, he cast several spells designed to prevent those still loyal to Galbatorix from working against her. The spells applied only to the people within the city and the adjacent lands, but having them in place made everyone in the Vardan feel safer. Aragorn noticed that the Vardan, the dwarves, and even the elves treated him and Saphira differently than they had before Galbatorix's death. They were more respectful and deferential, especially the humans, and they regarded him and Saphira with what he slowly came to understand was a sense of awe. He enjoyed it at first. Saphira did not seem to care one way or another, but it began to bother him when he realized that many of the dwarves and humans were so eager to please him. They would tell him whatever they thought he wanted to hear, and not the actual truth. The discovery unsettled him. He felt unable to trust anyone other than Rauron, Arya, Nessawada, Oryk, Horst, and of course, Saphira. He saw little of Arya during those days. The few times they met, she seemed withdrawn, which he recognized was her way of dealing with her grief. They never had a chance to talk in private, and the only condolences he was able to offer were brief and awkward. He thought she appreciated them, but it was hard to tell. As for Nessawada, she seemed to regain much of her former drive, spirit, and energy after a single night's sleep, which amazed Aragorn. His opinion of her increased tremendously upon hearing her account of her ordeal in the Hall of the Soothsayer, as did his regard for Murtagh, of whom Nessawada spoke not a word thereafter. She complimented Aragorn on his leadership of the Vardan in her absence, although he protested that he had been gone most of that time, and thanked him for rescuing her as quickly as he had, for as she admitted late in their conversation, Galbatorix had nearly succeeded in breaking her. Upon the third day, Nessawada was coronated in a great square near the center of the city, in full view of a vast crowd of humans, dwarves, elves, weircats, and urgles. The explosion that had ended Galbatorix's life had destroyed the ancient crown of the Brodrings, so the dwarves had forged a new crown from gold found in the city and from jewels the elves had taken from their helms or from the pommels of their swords. The ceremony was simple, but all the more effective for it. Nessawada approached on foot from the direction of the ruined citadel. She wore a dress of royal purple, cut short at the elbows, so that all might see the scars that lined her forearms, with a train fringed with mink, which Elva carried. For Aragorn had heeded Murtagh's warning and insisted that the girl stay as close to Nessawada as possible. A slow drumbeat sounded as Nessawada walked up to the dais that had been erected in the center of the square. At the top of the dais, next to the carved chair that would serve as her throne, stood Aragorn, with Saphira close behind. In front of the raised platform were the kings Orin, Oryk, and Grimur, along with Arya, Dathadur, and Nargarjvag. Nessawada ascended the dais, then knelt before Aragorn and Saphira. A dwarf of Oryk's clan presented Aragorn with the newly made crown, which he placed upon Nasawada's head. Then Saphira arched her neck and with her snout touched Nessawada upon the brow, and both she and Aragorn said, Rise now as queen, Nasawada, daughter of Arjahad and Nadara. A fanfare of trumpets rang forth, and the gathered crowd, which had been deathly silent, began to cheer. It was a strange cacophony, what with the bellows of Urgals intermingled with the melodious voices of the elves. Then Nasawada sat upon the throne. King Orin came before her and swore his allegiance, followed by Arya, King Oric, Grimur Halfpaw, and Nar Garjvag, who each pledged the friendship of their respective races. The event affected Aragorn strongly. He found himself holding back tears as he gazed at Nasawada sitting regnant on her throne. Only with her coronation did it feel as if the spectre of Galbatorix's oppression had begun to recede. Afterward they feasted, and the Varden and their allies celebrated throughout the night and into the next day. Aragorn remembered little of the festivities, save the dancing of the elves, the pounding of the dwarves' drums, and the four Kull who climbed a tower along the city wall, and there stood blowing horns made from the skulls of their fathers. The people of the city joined in the celebrations as well, and among them Aragorn saw relief and jubilation that Galbatorix was no longer king. And underlying their emotions, and those of everyone present, was an awareness of the importance of the moment. For they knew they were witnessing the end of one age and the beginning of another. Upon the fifth day, when the gate was nearly rebuilt and the city seemed reasonably secure, Nasawada ordered Aragorn and Saphira to fly to Drosleona, and thence to Bellatona, Feinster, and Aros, and in each place to use the name of the ancient language to release from their oaths everyone who had sworn fealty to Galbatorix. She also asked Aragorn to bind the soldiers and nobles with spells, even as he had bound the people of Urubane, to keep them from trying to undermine the newly established peace. That Aragorn had refused, for he felt it was too similar to how Galbatorix had controlled those who served him. In Urubane, the risk of hidden killers or other loyalists was great enough that Aragorn had been willing to do as she wished, but not elsewhere. To his relief, Nasawada agreed with him, after some consideration. He and Saphira took with them over half the Eldenari from Vroengard. The rest remained behind, with the Hearts of Hearts that had been rescued from Galbatorix's treasure room. Blodgarm and his spellcasters, who were no longer bound to defend Aragorn and Saphira, moved those Eldenari to a castle several miles northeast of Urubane, where it would be easy to protect the hearts against any who might seek to steal them, and where the thoughts of the mad dragons would not affect the minds of any but their caretakers. Only once Aragorn and Saphira were satisfied that the Eldenari were safe, did they depart. When they arrived at Drosleona, Aragorn was astounded by the number of spells he found woven throughout the city, as well as in the dark tower of stone, Helgrind. Many of them, he guessed, were hundreds of years old, if not older, forgotten enchantments from ages past. He left those that seemed harmless, and removed those that did not. But oft-times it was difficult to tell, and he was reluctant to tamper with spells whose purpose he did not understand. Here the Eldunari proved helpful. In several cases they remembered who had cast a spell and why, or else they were able to divine its purpose from information that meant nothing to him. When it came to Helgrind and the various holdings of the priests, who had gone into hiding as soon as news of Galbatorix's demise had reached them, Aragorn did not bother trying to determine which spells were dangerous and which were not. He removed them all. He also used the Name of Names to search for the Belt of Beloth the Wise in the ruins of the great cathedral, but without success. They stayed in Drosleona for 3 days. Then they proceeded to Bellatona. There too, Aragorn removed Galbatorix's enchantments, as well as at Feinster and Aros. In Feinster, someone tried to kill him with a poisoned drink. His wards protected him, but the incident angered Saphira.
"If I ever corner the rat coward who did this, I'll eat him alive from the toes up," she growled.
On the return trip to Urubane, Aragorn suggested a slight change of direction. Saphira agreed and altered her course, tilting so the horizon stood on end, and the world was divided equally between the dark blue sky and the green and brown earth. It took a half day of searching, but at last Sapphira found the cluster of sandstone hills, and among them one hill in particular, a tall, sloping mound of reddish stone with a cave halfway up its side, and upon its crest a glittering tomb of diamond. The hill looked exactly as Eragon remembered. When he gazed upon it, he felt his chest grow tight. Sapphira landed next to the tomb. Her claws scraped against the pitted stone, chipping off flakes. With slow fingers, Eragon unbuckled his legs. Then he slid to the ground. A wave of dizziness passed through him at the smell of the warm stone, and for a moment he felt as if he were in the past. Then he shook himself, and his mind cleared. He walked to the tomb and looked into its crystal depths, and there he saw Brom. There he saw his father. Brom's appearance had not changed. The diamond that encased his body protected him from the ravages of time, and his flesh showed no hint of decay. The skin of his lined face was firm, and it had a rosy tint, as if hot blood still coursed beneath the surface. At any moment it seemed as if Brom might open his eyes and rise to his feet, ready to continue on their unfinished journey. In a way, he had become deathless, for he no longer aged as others did, but would remain forever the same, caught in a dreamless sleep. Brom's sword lay atop his chest and the long white pennant of his beard, with his hands folded over the hilt, just as Eragon had placed them. By his side was his gnarled staff, carved, Eragon now realized, with dozens of glyphs from the ancient language. Tears welled in Eragon's eyes. He fell to his knees and wept quietly for a timeless while. He heard Sapphira join him, felt her with his mind, and he knew that she too mourned Brom's passing. At last, Eragon got to his feet and leaned against the edge of the tomb as he studied the shape of Brom's face. Now that he knew what to look for, he could see the similarities between their features, blurred and obscured by age and by Brom's beard, but still unmistakable. The angle of Brom's cheekbones, the crease between his eyebrows, the way his upper lip curved, all those Eragon recognized. He had not inherited Brom's hooked nose, however. His nose he had gotten from his mother. Eragon looked down, breathing heavily, as his eyes again grew blurry. "It's done," he said in an undertone. "I did it. We did it. Galbatorix is dead. Nasawada is on the throne. And both Sapphira and I are unharmed. That would please you, wouldn't it, you old fox?" He laughed shortly and wiped his eyes with the back of his wrist. "What's more, there are dragon eggs in Vroengard. Eggs! The dragons aren't going to die out, and Sapphira and I will be the ones to raise them. You never foresaw that, now did you?" He laughed again, feeling silly and grief-stricken at the same time. "What would you think of this all, I wonder? You're the same as ever, but we're not. Would you even recognize us?"
"Of course he would," said Sapphira. "You are his son."
She touched him with her snout.
"Besides, your face isn't so different that he would mistake you for someone else, even if your scent has changed."
"It has?"
"You smell more like an elf now. Anyway, he would hardly think I was Shrukan or Glader, now would he?"
"No." Eragon sniffed and pushed himself off the tomb. Brom looked so lifelike within the diamond, the sight of him inspired an idea, a wild, improbable idea that he almost dismissed, but that his emotions would not let him ignore. He thought of Umaroth and the Eldunari, of all their collected knowledge, and of what they had accomplished with his spell in Urabain, and a spark of desperate hope kindled within his heart. Speaking both to Sapphira and Umaroth, he said, Brom had only just died when we buried him. Saphira didn't turn the stone to diamond until the following day, but he was still encased in stone, away from the air through the night. Umarov, with your strength and your knowledge, maybe we could still heal him. Aragorn shivered as if he were in the grip of a fever. I didn't know how to mend his wound before, but now I think I could.
It would be more difficult than you imagine, said Umarov.
Yes, but you could do it, said Aragorn. I've seen you and Saphira accomplish amazing things with magic. Surely this isn't beyond you.
You know that we cannot use magic on command, said Saphira. And even if we succeeded, said Umarov, there is every chance that we would be unable to restore Brom's mind to what it was. Minds are complicated things, and he might easily end up with his wits muddled, or his personality altered. And then what? Would you want him to live like that? Would he? No, it is best to let him be, Aragorn, and to honor him with your thoughts and actions, as you have. You wish it were otherwise. So do all who have lost one they care about. However, it is the way of things. Brom lives on in your memories, and if he was the man you showed us, he would be content with that. Let you be content with that as well.
But... It was not Umarov who interrupted, but the oldest of the Eldunari, Baldur. He surprised Aragorn by speaking not in images or feelings, but in words of the ancient language, strained and labored, as if each was foreign to him. And he said,
Leave the dead to the earth. They are not for us.
Then he spoke no more, but Aragorn felt from him a great sadness and sympathy. Aragorn let out a long sigh and closed his eyes for a moment. Then in his heart, he allowed himself to release his misguided hope and again accept the fact that Brom was gone.
Ah, he said to Saphira, I didn't think this would be so difficult.
It would be strange if it were not.
He felt her warm breath ruffle the hair on the top of his head as she touched his back with the side of her muzzle. He smiled weakly and gathered up his courage to look at Brom again. Father, he said. The word tasted strange in his mouth. He had never had cause to say it to anyone before. Then Aragorn shifted his gaze to the runes he had set into the spire at the head of the tomb, which read, Here lies Brom, who was a dragon rider, and like a father to me. May his name live on in glory. He smiled painfully at how close he had come to the truth. Then he spoke in the ancient language, and he watched the diamond shimmer and flow as a new pattern of runes formed upon its surface. When he finished, the inscription had changed to, Here lies Brom, who was a rider, bonded to the dragon Saphira, son of Holcim and Nelda, beloved of Selina, father of Aragorn Shadeslayer, founder of the Varden and bane of the Forsworn. May his name live on in glory, Steiger Unan Moranar. It was a less personal epitaph, but it seemed more fitting to Aragorn. Then he cast several spells to protect the diamond from thieves and vandals. He continued to stand next to the tomb, reluctant to turn away, and feeling as if there ought to be something more, some event or emotion or realization that would make it easier for him to say farewell to his father, and thus to leave. At last he put his hand atop the cool diamond, wishing that he could reach through it to touch Brom one final time, and he said,
Thank you for everything you taught me. Sephira snorted and bowed her head until her snout tapped against the hard jewel. Then Aragorn turned, and with a sense of finality, he slowly climbed onto Sephira's back. He was somber for a time as Sephira took off and flew northeast toward Urabain. When the patch of sandstone hills was no more than a smudge on the horizon, he let out a long breath and looked up into the azure sky. A smile split his face.
"What is so amusing?"
asked Sephira, and she swung her tail back and forth. "The scale on your snout is regrowing." Her delight was evident. Then she sniffed and said,
"I always knew it would. Why would it not?"
However, he could feel her sides vibrating against his heels as she hummed with satisfaction, and he patted her and laid his chest against her neck, feeling the warmth from her body seeping into his. Pieces on a Board. When he and Sephira arrived at Urabain, Aragorn was surprised to discover that Nasawada had restored its name to Illyria, out of respect for its history and heritage. Also, he was dismayed to learn that Arya had departed for Ellesmira, along with Dathomir and many of the other High Elf Lords, and that she had taken with her the green dragon egg they had found in the citadel. She had left a letter for him with Nasawada. In it, Arya explained that she needed to accompany her mother's body back to Duweldenvarden for a proper burial. As for the dragon egg, she wrote, "And because Sephira chose you, a human, to be her rider, it is only right that an elf should be the next rider, if the dragon within this egg agrees. I wish to give it that chance without delay. Already it has spent far too long within its shell. Since there are many more eggs elsewhere, I shall not name the place. I hope you do not believe that I have acted presumptuously, or that I have been overly prejudiced in favor of my own race. I consulted with the Eldunari upon this matter, and they agreed with my decision. In any event, with both Galbatorix and my mother having passed into the void, I no longer wish to continue as ambassador to the Varden. Rather, I wish to resume my task of ferrying a dragon egg throughout the land, as I did with Sephira's. Of course, an ambassador between our races is still needed. Therefore, Dathomir and I have appointed as my replacement a young elf named Vanar, whom you met during your time in Ellesmira. He has expressed a desire to learn more about the people of your race, and that seems to me as good a reason as any for him to have the post, so long as he does not prove completely incompetent, that is." The letter continued for several more lines, but Arya gave no indication of when, if ever, she might return to the western half of Alagasia. Aragorn was pleased that she had thought enough of him to write, but he wished that she could have waited until their return before she had departed. With her gone, there was a hole in his world. And though he spent a fair amount of time with Rauron and Katrina, as well as Nasawada, the aching emptiness within him refused to subside. That, along with his continued sense that he and Sephira were merely biding their time, left him with a feeling of detachment. It often seemed as if he were watching himself from outside his body, as might a stranger. He understood the cause of his feelings, but he could think of no cure other than time. During their recent trip, it had occurred to him that with the command of the ancient language bestowed by the Name of Names, he could remove from Elva the last vestiges of his blessing that had proved a curse. So he went to the girl where she was living in Nasawada's grand hall, and he told her his idea, then asked her what she wanted. She did not react with the delight he expected, but sat staring at the floor, a frown upon her pale face. She remained silent for the better part of an hour, he sitting across from her, waiting without complaint. Then she looked at him and said, "No, I would rather stay as I am. I am grateful that you thought to ask, but this is too large a part of me,
and I cannot give it up. Without my ability to sense others' pain, I would only be an oddity, a misbegotten aberration, good for nothing but satisfying the low-minded curiosity of those who consented to have me around, of those who tolerated me. With it, I am still an oddity, but I can be useful as well, and I have a power that others fear, and a control over my own destiny, which many of my sex do not. She gestured at the ornate room where she was staying. Here I can live in comfort, I can live in peace, and yet I can continue to do some good by helping Nasuada. If you take away my ability, then what would I have? What would I do? What would I be? To remove your spell would be no blessing, Aragorn. No, I will stay as I am, and I will bear the trials of my gift of my own free will. But I do thank you. 2 days after he and Saphira alit in what was now Illyria, Nasuada sent them out once more, first to Gilead and then to Siunon, the two cities that the elves had captured, so that Aragorn could again use the name of names to clear away Galbatorix's spells. Both Aragorn and Saphira found Gilead unpleasant to visit. It reminded them of when the Urgals had captured Aragorn at Durza's orders, and also of Oromus's death. Aragorn and Saphira slept in Siunon for 3 nights. It was unlike any other city they had seen before. The buildings were mainly wood, with steep, shingled roofs that, in the case of the larger houses, had several layers. The peaks of the roofs were often decorated with a stylized carving of a dragon head, while the doors were carved or painted with elaborate, knot-like patterns. When they departed, Saphira was the one who suggested a change of path. She did not have to try very hard to convince Aragorn. He was happy to agree once she explained that the side trip would not take too long. From Siunon, Saphira flew westward across the Bay of Fundor, a broad, white-capped expanse of water. The grey and black humps of great sea fish often breached the waves like small leathery islands. Then they would spray water from their blowholes and lift their flukes high into the air before slipping back into the silent depths. Across the Bay of Fundor, through winds cold and blustery, and then across the mountains of the Spine, each of which Aragorn knew by name, and thus to Palancar Valley, for the first time since they had set off in pursuit of the Razak, along with Brom, what seemed like a lifetime ago. The valley smelled like home to Aragorn. The scent of the pines and the willows and the birches reminded him of his childhood, and the bitter bite of the air told him that winter was near. They landed in the charred ruins of Carvajal, and Aragorn wandered along streets fringed with encroaching grass and weeds. A pack of wild dogs trotted out of a nearby stand of birch. They stopped when they saw Saphira, then snarled, yelped, and ran for cover. Saphira growled and loosed a puff of smoke, but made no move to chase them. A piece of burnt wood cracked under Aragorn's foot as he dragged his boot through a pile of ashes. The destruction of the town left him saddened. But most of the villagers who had escaped were still alive. If they returned, Aragorn knew that they would rebuild Carvajal and make it better than it had been. The buildings he had grown up with, though, were gone forever. Their absence exacerbated his feeling that he no longer belonged in Palancar Valley, and the empty spaces where they ought to have been left him with a sense of wrongness, as if he were in a dream where everything was off kilter. "The world is out of joint," he murmured. Aragorn built a small campfire next to what had been Morn's tavern, and he cooked a large pot of stew. While he ate, Saphira prowled the surrounding landscape, sniffing at whatever she found interesting. When the stew was gone, Aragorn carried his pot, bowl and spoon to the Anora River and washed them in the icy water. He sat squatting on the rocky shore and stared at the drifting white plume at the head of the valley, the Igualda Falls, which stretched upward for half a mile before disappearing over a shoulder of stone high on Narnmore Mountain. Seeing it brought back the evening he had returned from the spine with Sephira's egg in his pack, knowing nothing of what lay before the two of them, or even that there would be two of them. "Let's go," he said to Sephira, rejoining her by the caved-in well in the centre of the town.
"Do you want to visit your farm?"
she asked as he took his place on her back. He shook his head. "No. I would rather think of it as it was, not as it is." She agreed. However, by unspoken consent, she flew south, following the same path as when they had left Palancar Valley. Along the way, Aragorn glimpsed the clearing where his home had been, but it was distant and obscure enough that he was able to pretend that perhaps the house and barn were still intact. At the southern end of the valley, Sephira rode a pillar of rising air up to the top of the huge bare mountain, Utgard, where stood the crumbling turret the riders had built to keep watch over Mad King Palancar. The turret had once been known as Edoxil, but now bore the name Ristvakbane, or the Place of Sorrow, as it was there that Galbatorix had slain Vrail. In the ruins of the turret, Aragorn, Sephira, and the Eldunari with them paid their respects to the memory of Vrail. Umaroth in particular was somber, but he said,
"Thank you for bringing me here, Sephira. I never thought to see the place where my rider fell."
Then Sephira spread her wings and leaped out of the turret and soared away from the valley and over the grassy plains beyond. Halfway to Illyria, Nasawada contacted them through one of the Varden's magicians and ordered them to join a large group of warriors she had sent to march from the capital to Tirm. Aragorn was pleased to learn that Rohan commanded the warriors, and that among their ranks were Jode, Baldur, who had regained full use of his hand after the elves reattached it, and several more of the villagers. Somewhat to Aragorn's surprise, the people of Tirm refused to surrender, even after he released them from their oath to Galbatorix, and even though it was obvious that the Varden, with Sephira and Aragorn to help, could easily capture the city if they wished. Instead, the governor of Tirm, Lord Ristart, demanded that they be allowed to become an independent city-state, with the freedom to choose its own rulers and set its own laws. In the end, after several days of negotiations, Nasawada agreed to his terms, provided that Lord Ristart swore allegiance to her as High Queen, even as King Orin had, and consented to abide by her laws concerning magicians. From Tirm, Aragorn and Sephira accompanied the warriors south, along the narrow coast, until they arrived at the city of Kuasta. They repeated the process from Tirm, but unlike Tirm, the governor of Kuasta yielded and agreed to join Nasawada's new kingdom. Then Aragorn and Sephira flew alone to Narda, far to the north, and extracted the same promise from them, before finally returning to Illyria, where they stayed for some weeks in a hall next to Nasawada's. When time allowed, he and Sephira left the city and went to the castle where Blodgarm and the other spellcasters guarded the Eldunari rescued from Galbatorix. There, Aragorn and Sephira aided in the effort to heal the minds of the dragons. They made progress, but it was slow, and some of the Eldunari responded faster than others. Many of them, Aragorn worried, simply did not care about life anymore, or were so lost within the labyrinths of their minds that it was almost impossible to communicate with them in a meaningful manner, even for the elder dragons such as Valdur. To prevent the hundreds of maddened dragons from overwhelming those who were trying to help them, the elves kept most of the Eldunari in a trance-like state, choosing to interact with only a few at a time. Aragorn also labored alongside the magicians of Dúvrangar Gata to empty the citadel of its treasures. Much of the work fell to him, as none of the other spellcasters had the knowledge or experience needed to deal with many of the enchanted artifacts Galbatorix had left behind. But Aragorn did not mind. He enjoyed exploring the damaged fortress and discovering the secrets that lay hidden therein. Galbatorix had collected a host of wonders over the past century, some more dangerous than others, but all of them interesting. Aragorn's favorite was an astrolabe that, when put to his eye, allowed him to see the stars even in daylight. He kept the existence of the most perilous artifacts a secret between him, Sephira, and Nasuwada, deeming it too risky to allow knowledge of them to spread. Nasuwada put the trove of riches they recovered from the citadel to immediate use, feeding and clothing her warriors, as well as rebuilding the defenses of the cities they had captured during their invasion of the empire. In addition, she gave a gift of 5 gold crowns to every one of her subjects, a trifling amount to the nobles, but a veritable fortune to the poorer farmers. The gesture Aragorn knew earned her their respect and allegiance in a way Galbatorix would never have understood. They also recovered 700 riders' swords, swords of every colour and shape, made for both humans and elves. It was a breathtaking find. Aragorn and Sephira personally carried the weapons to the castle where the Eldunari were, in anticipation of the day when they would again be needed by riders. Runan, Aragorn thought, would be pleased to know that so much of her handiwork had survived. And there were the thousands of scrolls and books that Galbatorix had collected, which the elves and Jod helped to catalogue, setting aside those that contained secrets about the riders or the inner workings of magic. As they sorted through Galbatorix's great hoard of knowledge, Aragorn kept hoping that they would find some mention of where the king had hidden the rest of the Leatherblocker's eggs. However, the only mentions of the Leatherblocker or the Razak he saw were in works by the elves and the riders from ages past, where they discussed the dark menace of the night and wondered what was to be done about a foe that could not be detected with magic of any sort. Now that Aragorn could speak openly with him, he found himself talking with Jod on a regular basis, confiding in him all that had happened with the Eldunari and the eggs, and even going so far as to tell him about the process of finding his true name on Vroengard. Talking with Jod was a comfort, especially as he was one of the few people who had known Brom well enough to call him a friend. Aragorn found it interesting, in a rather abstract way, to watch what went into ruling and rebuilding the kingdom Nasuwada had formed from the remnants of the empire. The amount of effort required to manage such an enormous and diverse country was tremendous, and the task never seemed finished. There was always more that needed doing. Aragorn knew that he would have hated the demands of the position, but Nasuwada appeared to thrive upon them. Her energy never flagged, and she always seemed to know how to solve the problems that came before her. Day by day, he saw her stature grow among the emissaries, functionaries, nobles, and commoners with whom she dealt. She seemed perfectly suited for her new role, although he was not sure how happy she really was, and he worried about her because of it. He watched how she rendered judgment upon the nobles who had worked with Galbatorix, willingly or not, and he approved of the fairness and mercy she displayed, as well as the punishments she meted out when necessary. Most she stripped of their lands, titles, and the better portion of their ill-gotten wealth, but she did not have them executed, for which Aragorn was glad. He stood by her side when she granted Nargajvog and his people vast swathes of land along the northern coast of the Spine, as well as along the fertile plains between Lake Flam and the Tork River, where few, if any, people now lived. And that, too, Aragorn approved of. Like King Orin and Lord Ristharth, Nargajvag had sworn fealty to Nasuwada as his High Queen. However, the huge Kull said,
"My people agree with this, Lady Nightstalker, but they have thick blood and short memories, and words will not bind them forever."
In a cold voice, Nasuwada replied,
"Do you mean to say your people will break the peace? Am I to understand our races will once again be enemies?"
"No,"
said Garjvag, and shook his massive head.
"We do not want to fight you. We know that Fire Sword would kill us. But when our young ones have grown, they will want battles in which to prove themselves. If there are no battles, then they will start them. I am sorry, Nightstalker, but we cannot change what we are.
The exchange troubled Aragorn, and Nasawada as well, and he spent several nights thinking about the Urgals, trying to solve the problem they presented. As the weeks rolled by, Nasawada continued to send him and Saphira to various locations within Cirda and her kingdom, often using them as her personal representative to King Orin, Lord Ristart, and the other nobles and groups of soldiers throughout the land. Wherever they went, they searched for a place that could serve as a home for the Eldunari in the centuries to come, and as nesting and proving grounds for the dragons hidden on Vroengard. There were areas of the spine that showed promise, but most were too close to humans or Urgals, or else were so far north. Aragorn thought it would be miserable to live there year-round. Besides, Murtagh and Thorn had gone north, and Aragorn and Saphira did not want to cause them additional difficulty. The Beorn Mountains would have been perfect, but it seemed doubtful that the dwarves would welcome hundreds of ravenous dragons hatching within the bounds of their realm. No matter where they went in the Beors, they would still be a short flight from at least one dwarven city, and it would not do if a young dragon were to start raiding the dwarves' flock of Feldunost, which, knowing Saphira, Aragorn deemed more than likely. The elves would, he thought, have no objection to the dragons living on or around one of the mountains in Dueldenvarden, but Aragorn still worried about their nearness to the elven cities. Also, he disliked the idea of placing the dragons and the Eldunari within the territory of any one race. Doing so would give the appearance that they were lending support to that race in particular. The riders of the past had never done that, nor, Aragorn believed, should the riders of the future. The only location that was far enough away from every town and city, and that no race had yet claimed, was the ancestral home of the dragons, the heart of the Haderach Desert, where stood Dufel's Nangoroth, the Blasted Mountains. It would, Aragorn was sure, be a fine place to raise hatchlings. However, it had three drawbacks. First, they would not be able to find enough food in the desert to feed the young dragons. Saphira would have to spend most of her time carrying deer and other wild animals to the mountains. And of course, once the hatchlings grew larger, they would have to start flying out on their own, which would take them close to the lands of either the humans, the elves, or the dwarves. Second, everyone who had travelled widely, and many who had not, knew where the mountains were. And third, it was not unduly difficult to reach the mountains, especially in the winter. The last two points concerned Aragorn the most, and made him wonder how well they would be able to protect the eggs, the hatchlings, and the Eldunari. "It would be better if we were high up on one of the peaks in the Beors, where only a dragon could fly," he said to Saphira. "Then no one would be able to sneak up on us. No one except for Thorn, Murtagh, or some other magician."
"Some other magician? Like every elf in the land? Besides, it would be cold all the time."
"I thought you didn't mind the cold."
"I don't. But I don't want to live in the snow year-round either. Sand is better for your scales, Glada told me. It helps polish them and keep them clean."
Day by day, the weather grew colder. Trees shed their leaves, flocks of birds flew south for the year, and winter thus came upon the land. It was a cruel, harsh winter, and for a long while, it felt as if the whole of Alagaesia was locked in slumber. At the first fall of snow, Oric and his army returned to the Beor Mountains. All of the elves who were still in Illyria, save Vanna and Blodgarm and his 10 spellcasters, likewise left for Dueldenvarden. The Urgals had departed weeks earlier. Last to go were the Weircats. They seemed to simply disappear. No one saw them leave. And yet one day they were all gone, except for a large, fat weercat by the name of Yellow Eyes, who sat on the padded cushion next to Nasawada, purring, napping, and listening to everything that went on in the throne room. Without the elves and the dwarves, the city felt depressingly empty to Aragorn as he walked along the streets, ragged flakes of snow drifting sideways underneath the shelf of creviced stone overhead. And still, Nasawada continued to dispatch him and Sephira upon missions. But never did she send them to Duweldenvaden, the one place Aragorn wanted to go. They had had no word from the elves as to who had been chosen as Islanzadi's successor. And when asked, Vanna would only say, "We are not a hasty people, and for us appointing a new monarch is a difficult, complicated process. As soon as I learn what our councils have decided, I will tell you." It had been so long since Aragorn had seen or heard from Arya, he considered using the name of the ancient language to bypass the wards around Duweldenvaden, so that he could communicate with, or at least scry her. However, he knew the elves would not look kindly on the intrusion, and he feared Arya would not appreciate him contacting her in that way without a pressing need. Therefore, he instead wrote her a short letter, asking after her, and telling her some of what he and Sephira had been doing. He gave the letter to Vanna, and Vanna promised that he would have it sent to Arya at once. Aragorn was sure that Vanna kept his word, for they had been speaking in the ancient language, but he received no response from Arya. And as the moons waxed and waned, he began to think that for some unknown reason, she had decided to end their friendship. The thought hurt him terribly, and it caused him to concentrate on the work Nasawada gave him with even greater intensity, hoping to forget his misery. In the deepest part of winter, when sword-like icicles hung from the shelf above Illyria and deep drifts of snow lay upon the surrounding landscape, when the roads were nearly impassable and the fare at their tables had grown lean, 3 attempts were made on Nasawada's life, as Murtagh had warned might happen. The attempts were clever and well thought out, and the 3rd one, which involved a net full of stones falling on Nasawada, nearly succeeded. But with Aragorn's wards and Elva to protect her, Nasawada survived, although the last attack cost her several broken bones. During the 3rd attempt, Aragorn and the Nighthawks managed to kill 2 of Nasawada's attackers, the exact number of which remained a mystery, but the rest escaped. Aragorn and Jormungandr went to extraordinary lengths to ensure Nasawada's safety after that. They increased the number of her guards once again, and wherever she went, at least 3 spellcasters accompanied her. Nasawada herself grew ever more wary, and Aragorn saw in her a certain hardness that had not been apparent before. There were no more attacks upon Nasawada's person, but a month after winter broke and the roads were again clear, a displaced earl by the name of Hamlin, who had gathered up several 100 of the Empire's former soldiers, started launching raids against Gilead and attacking the travellers on the roads thereabouts. At the same time, another slightly larger rebellion began to brew in the south, led by Tharos the Quick of Aros. The uprisings were more of a nuisance than anything, but they still took several months to quell, and they resulted in a number of unexpectedly savage fights. Although Aragorn and Sephira attempted to settle matters peacefully whenever they could, after the battles they had already participated in, neither of them was thirsty for more blood. Soon after the end of the uprisings, Katrina gave birth to a large, healthy girl, with a lock of red hair atop her head, the same as her mother. The girl bawled louder than any infant Aragorn had ever heard, and she had a grip like iron. Roran and Katrina named her Ismira, after Katrina's mother, and whenever they looked at her, the joy in their faces made Aragorn grin as well. The day after Ismira's birth, Nasawada summoned Roran to her throne room and surprised him by granting him the title of Earl, along with the whole of Palancar Valley as his domain. "As long as you and your descendants remain fit to rule, the valley shall be yours," she said. Roran bowed and said, "Thank you, Your Majesty." The gift Aragorn could see meant almost as much to Roran as had the birth of his daughter, for after his family, the thing Roran prized most was his home. Nasawada also tried to give Aragorn various titles and lands, but he refused them, saying, "It is enough to be a rider.
I need nothing more. A few days later, Aragorn was standing with Nasawada in her study, examining a map of Alagaesia and discussing matters of concern throughout the land, when she said, "Now that things are somewhat more settled, I think it's time to address the role of magicians within Cirda, Tirm, and my own kingdom." "Oh?" "Yes. I've spent a great deal of time thinking about it, and have reached a decision. I have decided to form a group, much like the Riders, but for magicians alone."
"And what will this group do?"
Nasawada picked up a quill from her desk and rolled it between her fingers. "Again, much the same as the Riders. Travel through the land, keep the peace, resolve disputes of law, and most important, watch over their fellow spellcasters, so as to ensure they do not use their ability for ill."
Aragorn frowned slightly. "Why not just leave that to the Riders?"
"Because it will be years before we have more of them. And even then, there won't be enough to mind every petty conjurer and hedge witch. You still haven't found a place to raise the dragons, have you?"
Aragorn shook his head.
Both he and Saphira had been feeling increasingly impatient, but as of yet, they and the Eldunari had been unable to agree upon a location. It was becoming a sore point between them, for the infant dragons needed to hatch as soon as possible.
"I thought not. We have to do this, Aragorn, and we cannot afford to wait. Look at the havoc Galbatorix wrought. Magicians are the most dangerous creatures in this world, even more dangerous than dragons, and they have to be held accountable. If not, we'll always be at their mercy."
"Do you really believe you will be able to recruit enough magicians to watch over all of the other spellcasters, here and in Cirda?"
"I think so, if you ask them to join. Which is one of the reasons I want you to lead this group."
"Me?"
She nodded. "Who else? Triana? I don't fully trust her, nor does she have the strength needed. An elf? No. It has to be one of our own. You know the name of the ancient language. You're a rider. And you have the wisdom and authority of the dragons behind you. I cannot think of a better person to lead the spellcasters. I've spoken to Orin about this, and he agrees."
"I can't imagine the idea pleases him."
"No, but he understands that it is necessary."
"Is it?" Aragorn picked at the edge of her desk, troubled. "How do you intend to keep watch over the magicians who don't belong to this group?
I hoped you might have some suggestions. I thought perhaps with spells and scrying mirrors, so that we could track their whereabouts and supervise their use of magic, lest they use it to better themselves at the expense of others."
"And if they do?"
"Then we see to it that they make amends for their crime, and we have them swear in the ancient language to give up the use of magic. Oaths in the ancient language won't necessarily stop anyone from using magic."
"I know, but it's the best we can do."
He nodded.
"And what if a spellcaster refuses to be watched? What then?
I can't imagine very many would agree to be spied upon."
A sigh escaped Nasawada, and she put down her quill.
"There's the difficult part. What would you do, Aragorn, if you were in my place?"
None of the solutions he thought of were very palatable.
"I don't know."
Her expression grew sad.
"Nor do I. This is a difficult, painful, messy problem. And no matter what I choose, someone will end up hurt. If I do nothing, the magicians will remain free to manipulate others with their spells. If I force them to submit to oversight, many will hate me for it. However, I think you will agree with me that it is better to protect the majority of my subjects at the expense of a few."
"I don't like it," he murmured.
"I don't like it either. You're talking about binding every human spellcaster to your will, regardless of who they are."
She did not blink.
"For the good of the many. What about people who can only hear thoughts and nothing more? That's a form of magic as well."
"Them too. The potential for them to abuse their power is still too great."
Nasawada sighed then.
"I know this isn't easy, Aragorn,
But easy or not, it's something we have to address. Galbatorix was mad and evil, but he was right about one thing. The magicians need to be reined in. But not as Galbatorix intended. Something needs to be done, though. And I think my plan is the best solution possible. If you can think of another better way to enforce the rule of law among spellcasters, I would be delighted. Otherwise, this is the only path available to us, and I need your help to do it. So will you accept charge of this group, for the good of the country, and the good of our race as a whole? Aragorn was slow to answer. At last he said, If you don't mind, I'd like to think about it for a while, and I need to consult with Saphira. Of course. But don't think for too long, Aragorn. Preparations are already underway, and you will soon be needed. Afterward, Aragorn did not return directly to Saphira, but wandered through the streets of Illyria, ignoring the bows and the greetings from the people he passed. He felt uneasy, both with Nasawada's proposal and with life in general. He and Saphira had been idling for too long. The time had come for a change, and circumstances would no longer allow them to wait. They had to decide what they were going to do, and whatever they chose, it would affect the rest of their lives. He spent several hours walking and thinking, mainly about his ties and obligations. In late afternoon, he made his way back to Saphira, and without speaking, climbed onto her back. She leaped out of the courtyard of the hall and flew high above Illyria, high enough that they could see for hundreds of miles in every direction. There she stayed, circling. They spoke without words, exchanging their mind states. Saphira shared many of his concerns, but she was not as worried as he about their bonds with others. Nothing was as important to her as protecting the eggs and the Eldunari, and doing what was right for him and her. Yet Aragorn knew they could not just ignore the effects their choices would have, both political and personal. Finally, he said, What should we do? Saphira dipped as the wind underneath her wings slowed.
What we need to do, as has always been the case.
She said nothing more, but turned then and began to descend toward the city. Aragorn appreciated her silence. The decision would be harder for him to make than for her, and he needed to think about it on his own. When they landed in the courtyard, Saphira nudged him with her snout and said,
If you need to talk, I'll be here.
He smiled and rubbed the side of her neck, and then slowly walked to his rooms while staring at the floor. That night, when the waxing moon had just appeared beneath the edge of the cliff over Illyria, and Aragorn was sitting against the end of his bed, reading a book about the saddle-making techniques of the early riders, a flicker by the edge of his sight, like the flapping of a drape, caught his attention. He sprang to his feet, drawing Brisinger from its sheath. Then, in his open window, he saw a small three-masted ship woven from stalks of grass. He smiled and sheathed his sword. He held out his hand, and the ship sailed across the room and landed upon his palm, where it listed to one side. The ship was different from the one Arya had made during their travels together in the Empire, after he and Roran rescued Katrina from Helgrind. It had more masts, and it also had sails fashioned from the blades of grass. Though the grass was limp and browning, it had not dried out entirely, which led him to think that it had been picked only a day or two earlier. Tied to the middle of the deck was a square of folded paper. Aragorn carefully removed it, his heart pounding, then unfolded the paper on the floor. It read, in glyphs of the ancient language,
Aragorn, we have finally decided upon a leader, and I am on my way to Illyria to arrange an introduction with Nasawada. I would like to talk with you and Saphira first. This message should reach you 4 days before the half moon. If you would, meet me the day after you receive it, at the easternmost point of the Rama River. Come alone, and do not tell anyone else where you are going. Arya.
Aragorn smiled without meaning to. Her timing had been perfect. The ship had arrived exactly when she intended. Then his smile faded, and he reread the letter several more times. She was hiding something, that much was obvious. But what? Why meet in secret? Maybe Arya doesn't approve of the Elves' next ruler, he thought. Or maybe there's some other problem. And though Aragorn was eager to see her again, he could not forget how she had ignored him and Saphira. He supposed that from Arya's point of view the intervening months were a trifling amount of time, but he could not help feeling hurt. He waited until the first hint of sunlight appeared in the sky, then hurried down to wake Saphira and tell her the news. She was as curious as he, if not quite as excited. He saddled her, and then they left the city and set off to the northeast, having told no one of their plans, not even Gleda or the other Eldenari.